Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We accept the separation of church and state as an established intention of the Constitution, but in fact, the only relating lines are these. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The wall between church and state came in 1948 with the case of a woman from Champaign, Illinois, named Vashti McCollum. This hour, her story, as told in the documentary, The Lord is Not on Trial Here Today. And our guest is Jay Rosenstein, a three-time Emmy Award-winning independent documentary producer, director, writer, and editor. And we're looking forward to hearing from you as well, your questions about the separation between church and state, its origins, and the way the Constitution was interpreted at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@WPR.org. And Jay Rosenstein, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, your documentary opens with those lines from the First Amendment about religion. Go over what they are again, would you?
Well, the lines are just as you said just a few moments ago, which is these are the very first lines of the First Amendment, and they are, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And other than a mention in the actual text of the Constitution that there should be no religion test for anyone to hold public office, these are the only references to religion at all in the Constitution.
And when I first saw that last night, I guess, like a lot of people, I had taken for granted what the intention in the Constitution was, as we understand it today. But it surprised me because those lines, I mean, they are a little vague. So I guess that must be exactly what your film is about, how they ended up with the interpretation that we know today.
Yeah, well, that's part of it, certainly. You know, it's the story of the McCollum case, McCollum versus Board of Education, which is a not very well-known case at all, but is incredibly, incredibly historic and landmark. In this whole area, the case represents many, many firsts in American history regarding, as you say, the interpretation of those first few words of the First Amendment. But the film is also the story of a family, and particularly a woman who brought the case, Vashti McCollum. And, you know, it's also a way for us to understand that all these big cases as part of the Supreme Court history have people behind them and people who had to go through, in many cases, very, very hard struggles. And so it's kind of a mix between learning the history of essentially this phrase, separation of church and state, as well as the story of a family that has to go through hardships to bring a Supreme Court case forward.
And Vashti McCollum, her face is the first that we see in the documentary.
Yes.
In terms of your subjects, and she's quite old. Tell us what she was like when you found her.
Well, that's funny the way you mentioned that when you found her, as though, you know, I kind of discovered her. But really, it's true. I did find her in a way, which is I didn't know if she was even still alive. And I live in Champaign, Illinois, and I opened up the phone book, and her number was listed, and I called her up, and there she was.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it is, because, again, I had no idea if she was even alive at the time. But she was 92 years old when I met her and interviewed her, and she died a little bit more than a year later in 2006. So physically she was fairly frail, and you can see that in the film, and I show her sort of in that state intentionally because I think there's an interesting contrast between this sort of physically frail old woman and this incredibly strong, courageous, tough woman. So what she was like when I met her, I think, is very consistent with all the stories that I'd heard about what she was like over the years. She was a very tough woman. She was physically tiny, but very tough, strong, and you could tell she was somebody who, you know, you couldn't kind of put things over on. As her son Dan described her in a line that was in the original film but had to be cut out, she was a woman for which patience was no virtue.
That's a good line from a son. Yeah, she had an incredible spirit about her in the movie. Even at the age of 92, you could tell that she would be a person who would have the fortitude to go through this long fight that she did. And, you know, it was a painful one as the story unfolds. But let's start a little bit at the beginning there and talk about how this case unfolded with her son in school and the religious class that he was kind of ambivalent about taking.
Sure. Well, we're talking about the early 1940s here, which is where the story sort of begins. And in the 1940s here in America, it was actually quite common to have religion classes in public school. And when I say religion classes, I mean similar to Sunday school classes, like classes in religious instruction, classes that were promoting essentially a particular religion.
And this is public school?
Yes, this is public school. And so the estimate I read is there were upwards of 2 million kids at the time in the early 1940s who were enrolled in these kind of classes in public school. And at that time, the Champaign School District, Champaign, Illinois, decided to adopt a class like that, and it would be once a week. And the way they set it up is a religion teacher would come into the public school and for about an hour would have this sort of instructional class on religion. And the reason they did this is they felt that juvenile delinquency was on the rise and that this would be a way of stopping it or slowing it down. And in Champaign, Illinois, they made the class voluntary, which means you had to get permission from your parents or a parent to take the class. And they felt by doing that, there wouldn't be any problems regarding the Constitution further down the way. And so Vashti's son, Jim, sort of encountered this class when he hit fourth grade. And there was enormous pressure on all the kids to be in this class. The teachers were even pressuring students. The administrators were pressuring students. And Vashti, his mother, had grown up in a family that was somewhat indifferent to organized religion. And so she let Jim, after a lot of begging, she let him take this class. But when she found out that it was a class in essentially a Protestant instruction class, she decided that she didn't want him to be in this class.
Right. She sort of thought it was going to be about the morality and the history and the culture of religion, she said. And
right.
Instead, he came home with a picture of the resurrection.
Right. And I should point out, and this is one of the things that, you know, is so misunderstood around this issue, is that it is perfectly constitutional to have a class like what you were talking about, a class, for instance, in the history of religions. It's perfectly constitutional. Or to have a class about world religions, talking about all different kinds of religions and what people believe and all those kinds of things. And so those are all constitutional. I think there's a huge misunderstanding because there's a lot of people, particularly, I think, from a certain area of religion who like to say that, you know, God has been thrown out of the public schools and you can't talk about religion and you can't talk about God, and that's not true at all.
And from then on, she didn't want him in the class anymore.
Right.
And so he faced an incredible pressure from his peers about that. It wasn't pressure, it was bullying.
Yes, it wasn't pressure, it was getting beat up. And so, you know, he was beat up and ostracized because he was the only one in his fifth grade class who wasn't taking this religion class. So when it was time for religious instruction class, you know, they had to take him out of the class because he was not allowed to be in there. And they basically couldn't figure out what to do with him. And so they, you know, sat him out in the hall in a desk where students were sat when they were being punished. And, you know, again, by being called out, this really ostracized him from the rest of his classmates, and he started getting beat up. And finally, Vashti essentially decided she'd had enough. And what's interesting is when I interviewed her, and I'm sure you saw this in the film, you know, even at age 92, that many years later, you can still hear the passion and the anger in her voice when she said, "Never again will he be put in the hall."
Hmm. Well, that's the kind of person it would take to go through with this. And there were some really powerful moments in the film, her anger and her passion, and moments where she talks about what happened to her family and her son, about how he used to go swimming at the Y after school, and the kids would beat him up, and one day they took his shoes, and he had to walk all the way home in bare feet in the snow.
Right, right.
I mean, this was a rough time for them.
It was a terrible time for them, particularly after she filed the case, because once she filed to sue, it set off an explosion of publicity, and suddenly the family was essentially targeted by the entire community as being anti-religion and particularly anti-Christian, and they were ostracized and had to endure all kinds of pressure, and all kinds of things happened to them for doing this.
Well, let's skip ahead to the trial. And she had, we should point out, financial backing. There was a group who sort of underwrote her legal bills. Tell us about the trial and what happened.
Well, you know, the trial's an interesting story. You know, the trial took place in the Champaign County Courthouse, you know, in 1946. And in a sense, the fix was in, I would say, in many ways in the trial, because it came before a three-judge panel, and one of the judges had actually previously been a lawyer for the school board, and it was a suit of this woman against the school board. So clearly he had a conflict of interest and probably should have recused himself, but didn't. But it was clear that public opinion was so strongly against the McCollums, and what happened is the media really played this up as a battle of Christianity versus atheism, and really didn't talk much about the fact that this was a lawsuit about constitutionality. And so they made it out as this is sort of a war between atheists and religion, or religion and anti-religion. And, you know, it was even written about as being very similar to the Scopes trial, in that there was, you know, this huge amount of publicity and media frenzy around it, you know, which was especially unusual in this time period in the 1940s, where I think we're a little more used to media frenzy happening today. But mm-hmm. at that time, it really was this huge media frenzy that, you know, captured the media around the nation.
And it took a while. I mean, this trial, one of the things they did was they brought in some popular kids from the schools that knew Jim, who basically said, oh, this kid is a complete misfit. He's a weirdo, and that's why nobody likes him. We're not bullying
right.
him.
Right.
So that's some
exactly.
of the emotional devastation that came of it.
Yeah, and that's the way the defense attorney for the school board kind of played it. He decided that he would show that Jim was this weirdo misfit kid, and that all these problems were because he was this terrible kid. And that took a really huge emotional toll on Vashti, to basically see her kid being torn apart in this trial. And because this trial had so much media attention, so basically all around the country there are these press reports, you know, saying that her son is a misfit and a strange kid and a weird kid, and it took a terrible toll on her emotionally. And one of the things that didn't make it into the film that's, I think, actually quite poignant is that she was called to testify, and from the stand she actually admitted that she realized that by filing the suit it was probably going to hurt her son, but she felt strongly she had to do it anyways. But it was a hard thing for her to admit, even on the witness stand.
And what happened then? What happened? What was the next step in the trial? Because there was more than one.
Sure. Well, she lost at the circuit court level, which essentially was not a surprise. But the attorney that had been hired for her, you know, decided to make this into a sort of very flamboyant case and played up the whole kind of flamboyancy of it. And in doing that, really made things very difficult for the McCollum family, because he very strongly ridiculed religious people during the trial and ridiculed their Christian beliefs and made things very hard for her. So after they lost the trial, she immediately insisted that this lawyer be fired, and was able to find another attorney who was this retired, really old man, 66-year-old man who had been a law professor at Yale, who agreed to take her case, and they appealed to the Illinois Supreme Court, where she went to the oral arguments, and the justices were dozing off while the oral arguments were going on. so it was clear she was going to lose there, and she did lose there, and then they filed an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, and of course we're very fortunate that the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to take her case.
What was that like, that lead-up? I mean, this is a small-town woman from Champaign, Illinois. I mean, she was an educated woman, and she had a lot of passion. But that's a big deal for a wife from Urbana, Illinois in the 40s. What was it like for her to go through that?
Well, it was huge. You know, you're absolutely right. It was very unusual, particularly for a woman, to be leading a case like this in the 1940s. And in many ways, I look at Vashti McCollum as very much sort of a feminist pioneer. I don't know if she would agree with that characterization. I wish I could have asked her while she was still alive. But it was very unusual for a woman to take a lead on a case like this. One thing that I found very interesting is when she was talking about having to go to the Supreme Court, she had these kind of concerns that were very stereotypically female, which I thought were kind of funny. Her biggest concern when deciding to go to the oral arguments at the Supreme Court in Washington was what she was going to wear. And she was very, you know, concerned about what she would wear. But, you know, for good cause.
Because, well, I suppose she'd be in all the papers.
Exactly. And even we see that today, of course, even with female politicians. But there was a lot written about her in newspapers, which talked about her appearance and what she was wearing and what her personality seemed like, you know, in a way that would have never been done for a man. And again, you know, we see that today, you know, when, for instance, as you know, like when Hillary Clinton, for instance, was running for president, there'd be all kinds of, you know, media about how she dressed, what she looked like, and you very rarely hear that from about a man.
And how did that trial unfold?
Well, the Supreme Court trial unfolded very differently than the other trials, in that right from the start, the justices really started battering the lawyers with questions. And Vashti sort of felt right from the beginning that these were the first judges who were really paying attention. And as she said, I was finally getting my day in court. And so they were, you know, very strongly questioning both the attorneys, you know, about the particulars of this case. You know, other than that, with a Supreme Court case, that's sort of all the only window that the public gets into the process. After that, you know, the justices go off and they do their deliberations privately, and there's actually correspondence between the justices via letter about, you know, what they're thinking and how this thing might turn out, but none of us get to see that. So really all that happened was this one oral, you know, the oral arguments at the Supreme Court, again, where there were just many, many questions. And in many ways, the lawyer for the school board came in with a bit of a maybe an overconfident air. And perhaps this was a strategy of his to sort of come in with this great bravado, because it was a bit uncharacteristic of his personality. And, you know, in a sense, the justices really shot him down. They really kind of cut him down to size, and I don't think he made a particularly good impression on the Supreme Court justices.
Who were the justices sitting at that time? Who were the key players?
Well, I don't have the list of all of them, but the key player, the justice who eventually wrote the majority opinion was Hugo Black, who is really quite a famous figure in terms of this idea of separation of church and state in public schools, because, you know, he ended up authoring the two key majority opinions that brought that phrase really into our Constitution, which is one of the amazing things that the McCollum case does. It actually brings the phrase separation of church and state into the Constitution. But he was, you know, probably the most predominant justice. Felix Frankfurter, who is a very well-known liberal justice, was on that court. I'm drawing a blank now, Stanley Reed and some others. But Hugo Black, I think, is the most famous figure of that time period.
And how did Vashti McCollum feel when the judges came out to make their decision, to read their final word?
Well, you know, the justices don't actually read the word. What happens is they just sort of, it gets issued, you know, to the press or whatever. So the decision comes months and months after the oral arguments. So the oral arguments were in December of 47, and you know, you go through that process, and then you essentially go home and you wait. And you have no idea when you're going to find out what the ruling of your case is. And again, you know, you just kind of wait until there's some sort of public pronouncement by the court of what they've decided. But they don't do that in person. They issue, you know, I don't even know what they do today, if they issue a press release or they issue some sort of statement that gets picked up by the press. So, you know, she's just home waiting and waiting and waiting. And finally, you know, the phone rings. And it's a reporter from Washington asking for a comment, and so this is, you know, the moment that she's been waiting for, and so it's a reporter who tells her that she'd won the case.
It's so funny. You'd think her lawyer might have called her, or yeah.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It's interesting, but right, it's you know, the Washington Press, I guess, who are the first whoever are covering, you know, the Supreme Court. Get the first information, and that's really, I think, still true today. Although, to be honest, I don't know. Maybe they post it on the Supreme Court website. I honestly don't know how these things are announced today. But the first call was indeed from a reporter asking her for a comment, and he was the first to tell her, "Oh, by the way, you know, you've won. Now, can I have a comment?"
Oh, what a story. Well, let's take our first break right now as we talk with Jay Rosenstein, the 3-time Emmy Award-winning independent documentary producer, director, writer, and editor. And we're talking about his film, The Lord Is Not on Trial, here today. And we want to take your phone calls as well, your questions about the history of the separation of church and state, the McCollum trial, at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickard. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert, in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking this hour with Jay Rosenstein. He is the producer, director, writer, and editor of the documentary The Lord Is Not on Trial Here Today, the story of Vashti McCollum, whose trial in, she was based in Champaign, Illinois. It led to the separation of church and state as we know it today. And we'll take our first caller, Tony from Oconomowoc. Hi, Tony.
Hi there. I'd like to say we definitely need a separation of church and state, and a big shout-out goes to Thomas Jefferson.
Did we lose you? I think we did somehow. I'm sorry about that. I don't know what happened there. Let's see. How about a next caller? We have Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi, Hugh.
I remember going to school about that time that you're talking about. And there was a girl who was suddenly ostracized when the class idiot, you know, was a couple of years older than the rest of us, noticed that she did not raise her arm to say the Pledge of Allegiance to the United States. She was a Jehovah Witness. And if I'm not mistaken, there had been various court cases during World War II, and I don't know which way they went. But because she was a Jehovah, she was religious, but she was Jehovah Witness and would not salute the flag, and went through a lot of ostracism too. As I recall, the teachers did say that she had that right, but still, she was, you know, the teachers were reluctant to even say that, and you know, she did have a minority view and came under attack for that. During World War II, you had Quakers and a few others were allowed to be conscientious objectors, but there was and it was even worse in World War I. The Amish and so forth, who might speak German, the hatred of Germans in World War I was stimulated, you know, by the Woodrow Wilson government, the hatred of Germans. I should say that when I went to school, I went to a public school, but there was a catechism. We were allowed to go to catechism. Nuns would come to our school, and even in pouring rain, they could not enter, but they would take us to a nearby Catholic school, and twice a week for about an hour, we were given catechism. The other thing going the other way at the time, you had the America's Creed, the Pledge of what is that? I can't think of it now. But there was no under God in it.
Right.
One nation united, and of course this is the one I knew because it was godless for about 60 years, and then they inserted the phrase under God.
That's right, and that's in your film, isn't it, Jay Rosenstein? You've got some video of children saying the pledge, and those words aren't there.
Yes, there is a clip of that, and what's interesting is actually I really barely noticed that the phrase was missing, and it was my editor who pointed that out and insisted that I make sure I never take that part of the clip out because it is important for people to realize that it wasn't inserted until the early 1950s, yeah.
Which is interesting because that's after this case.
Yes, it is after this case. You know, the caller brought up an interesting point, which is about being taken out of school to go to, I think he said, a Catholic church mm-hmm. where they had a service. And, you know, what's very interesting is in the McCollum case, which got ruled in 1948, that case was about what was called released time religion class. So in the case of the McCollum case, a teacher would come into school, they'd have this religion class, and then that teacher would leave. And the court ruled overwhelmingly that this was unconstitutional. But just a couple years after that, another case came before the Supreme Court, which was identical to the McCollum case, except instead of the religion teacher coming into the school, what happened was what this caller just said. They would take the kids out of school and bring them somewhere else and give them religious instruction. And the court ruled that that was constitutional. So, you know, just a few years apart, you've got these two kind of decisions that almost feel a little bit contradictory. And for many of the historians believe that there were some justices that felt they had gone too far in the ruling on McCollum, that it sort of opened things up for too much separation. And so the second ruling was kind of their way of pulling back from it a little bit.
How would you characterize the separation of church and state today? Obviously, Vashti McCollum's case was a landmark, but how would you say that's progressed over the years?
Well, you know, I'm just in terms of talking about public school here, because that, you know, this was the first case really that established this idea in public school. But again, as I mentioned earlier, it's also the case where the phrase really becomes brought into the Constitution, essentially. I would say that, you know, it's a very confusing concept, I think, for a lot of people and even for a lot of schools and a lot of teachers and a lot of administrators as to what's allowable and what's not. And the reason why is because there have been a bunch of different cases now since the McCollum case about different aspects of religion and public school. For instance, the big one was school prayer, and a lot of people today, I think, don't realize that the court didn't outlaw specifically school prayer till 1962 and 63, which, you know, to me is not that long ago, if you consider when the Constitution was written. And so there have been a lot of different cases about specific incidences, such as prayers led at graduations and prayers being said over public address systems before football games. And, you know, the court rulings on these things over the years are not always consistent. And that's what I think adds to a certain amount of confusion about that. So there are people who feel very strongly in this idea of strict separation, meaning absolutely nothing about religion whatsoever should be in public school. And then there's sort of another school of thought of interpretation, which is that the First Amendment really means that the government can't play any favorites as far as a specific religion or even non-religion. It has to treat every one of these things equally. So there's a little bit of tension, I think, between those kind of two philosophies having to do with what the meaning of the First Amendment is.
And even in Vashti's day, when her son was in that class, there were people, you said, who were a little rattled that there were Protestant teachers in there instead of Catholic teachers.
Well, yeah, what's interesting is part of the history of public schools in this country, it really has a lot of controversy and tension between Protestants and Catholics. And one of the reasons that Catholic schools became common in this country, it's not the only reason, but one of them, is because so many Catholic students were being forced to say prayers and read from the Protestant Bible. And in fact, those Catholic schools in many cases were getting beaten and abused and all sorts of things for not participating. And that was one of the reasons that motivated Catholics to begin to start their own school system, was particularly just so their kids could be free of that kind of torment.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that. Let's take another caller here. We have Janice joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Janice.
Yeah, hi, Veronica, and your guest. Thank you. I guess I was born in 1948, went to a public school, grade school, until eighth grade, had a wonderful experience, always said the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, and One Nation Under God. It was fabulous, never, no problem. And then I ended up going to a Catholic high school. But anyway, it was a great experience for me. I personally feel offended today that this, quote, separation of church and state, which I thought only came up because of Jefferson, that it, you know, was not in the Constitution, as everybody seems to assume that it is, and tell me if I'm wrong. But and the fact that, you know, I would like to say freedom for religion today, not freedom from religion. And that, to me, is the emphasis today. Like, oh, my goodness. Oh, don't mention God. Don't mention Jesus. Don't mention anything like that, because you're, you know, completely blackballed today for that. And to me, it's like, you know, this was a Christian country when it was Abraham Lincoln, George Washington. When we go back to our basic tradition, and these were very holy, godly men, I'm sorry, but I'm happy we have One Nation Under God. I feel I'm blessed to be living in this country, because of those people in our Revolutionary War that came over here to have this freedom, you know, and that we can have our religion. I'm Catholic, but I'm happy to live here. Believe it. I'm happy to be able to speak and talk about God and Jesus and not feel afraid about it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call, Janice. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. Jay Rosenstein.
Yes.
What do you make of her call? And especially, you know, the ideas about where the separation of church and state is written.
Sure.
Currently. And what about the forefathers?
Yeah.
Founding fathers.
Yeah, she brought up a lot of points, and there's a lot in what she said, and I appreciate her call. It's first of all, she did bring up very correctly that the First Amendment does have two parts, and one of them is there should be no establishment of religion, and then the second part is that the government can't interfere with the free expression of religion for individuals. So there's two parts to the First Amendment, and sometimes those two parts can feel like they're contradictory. She brought up about the phrase separation of church and state, and she is correct in that those exact words, separation of church and state, do not appear in the body of the original Constitution. However, in the ruling, the Supreme Court ruling of McCollum versus Board of Education, essentially what the court does is brings that phrase into the Constitution. So in other words, the Constitution clearly says that the powers of the Supreme Court are to become law, and so the things that the Supreme Court decide become our law, whether or not those exact things are written into the Constitution or not. The phrase separation of church and state is generally credited to Thomas Jefferson in a letter that he wrote to the Baptists of Danbury, and he uses this phrase, the wall of separation between church and state, as a way of explaining his philosophy about the First Amendment. And I should point out, of course, that this is just Jefferson's opinion. And Jefferson, of course, is one of the founders of this country, but he's certainly not the only one. And so this is his opinion on about what the First Amendment means. And then, you know, fast forward to 1947, a case that comes right before the McCollum case, and then the McCollum case, and the court says that they agree with Jefferson's interpretation, that this is what the way they're going to interpret the Constitution, and again brings that phrase in. So a lot of people say that because the phrase separation of church and state itself is not written word for word in the Constitution, that somehow it's not legitimate. But that's not true, because, again, rulings by the Supreme Court become law of the land. So that's how this Supreme Court decided to interpret the First Amendment. The other thing she talked about is the Founding Fathers. And it's true that many of the colonies in America were founded as Christian colonies. Massachusetts, for instance, was originally founded to be a Christian colony. However, I think it's a bit sort of disingenuous then to just sort of move forward and say, because of that, we're a Christian country. Because that's not true. What happened then is the leaders of these colonies came together and they decided to write a constitution, a set of laws for all of us. And although every single one of the founders who wrote the Constitution were in one way or another Christian, they very clearly did not write anything about the Christianity, Jesus, God, or anything in the Constitution, and in fact made things very clear in the First Amendment when they said Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, that they were absolutely forbidding the United States of America for being a nation of any one religion.
I'm curious if we can get at a little more closely how they got from, let's see, the First Amendment about Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, how they got from that to their decision. Can you tease out that interpretation a little?
You mean the decision in the McCollum case?
Yes.
Is what you're looking for?
Yes.
Well, sure. They felt, first of all, one of the most historic things about the McCollum case is this is actually the first case where the court formally says that this phrase applies to bodies of state government, not just federal government. Okay, so again, you know, it's written Congress shall, and Congress we know as the federal government, and so the court in McCollum says, well, this applies to state governments as well, bodies of state government, and school districts, public school districts, are bodies of state government.
Mm-hmm.
So the court says these bodies are also bound by this First Amendment. And essentially the way the court interpreted it was that they felt that because the public school was giving this class in one particular religious sect, which was Protestant, there was a Protestant class. So in the process, the public school, meaning this agent of the government, was promoting the Protestant religion. And pretty much in any interpretation of the First Amendment, either strict separation or that the government cannot have a favorite religion, it has to treat all religions equally, they were not treating each religion equally. They were favoring the Protestant religion, and therefore that violated the Constitution.
That's so interesting, because what they're saying is that they're favoring the Protestant religion, not that it's unlawful or unconstitutional to have any religion in the school.
Well, you know,
that
again
came later.
Well, yeah, this is a source of a lot of debate, depending again upon you know, your reading of the First Amendment and what that means. But there seems to be clear understanding, as I said earlier, that you can teach about religion in public schools. I'm a professor at the University of Illinois, which is a public university, which means essentially it's run by the state government, and that makes it an agent of our government. We have a religion department here at Illinois. You can be a religion major, and there are classes given in Christianity and Catholicism and the New Testament and Christ. You know, so you can, and there's researchers who are doing scholarship on that. So all of that is perfectly constitutional to teach about religion. But what you can't do is you can't have classes that are promoting a particular religion.
Jay Rosenstein, our guest this hour, 3-time Emmy Award-winning independent producer of documentaries. He's also the director, writer, and editor of the documentary we're talking about today. It's called The Lord Is Not on Trial Here Today, the Vashti McCollum case about separation of church and state. And we welcome your phone calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert with you today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 12:30 today, join us for Chapter a Day. Jim Fleming is reading from Twice a Spy by Keith Thompson. What happens when a former CIA agent can no longer trust his own mind? That's 12:30's Chapter a Day. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, as we talk with Jay Rosenstein, producer, director, writer, and editor of the film The Lord Is Not on Trial here today, the story of the Vashti McCollum trial and the origins of our notions about separation of church and state. And we'll go to our next caller now. Daniel joins us from Madison. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. I listened with great interest about where this comes sourced from Jefferson about separation of church and state. To flesh that out a little bit more, he had support from a group called the Danbury Baptists, who apparently were seeking protection from Jefferson or some sort of help because other religious groups were putting them down for their particular religion. And a letter comes from the Danbury Baptists to Jefferson, and he responds, and he defines what he thinks the Establishment Clause means, and a wall of separation between church and state. Also, someone else earlier said the framers of the Constitution were very religious and Christian. I think George Washington, Jefferson, and many other ones were deists, and deists would not be considered Christians by other Christian denominations and so forth. So it's kind of an interesting past in that particular way. And Douglas, who wrote the opinion in the case that you're talking about, was very much aware. I think he even makes reference to Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists at that time. And just one other thing. One Nation Under God and the Pledge of Allegiance was inserted in the 1950s. It was written by a socialist minister who really objected that they would tamper with it in that particular way. He didn't want that in there. He wanted it to be neutral. There's a lot of misinformation concerning this because it's such a highly emotional issue. There's a book called The Separation of Church and State, Writings on a Fundamental Freedom by America's Founders, and it's edited by Forrest Church, and I would recommend that to anybody. And you see how confusing things were going back to before there even was a constitution and then afterward.
Great. Well, thank you for those points, Daniel. Appreciate it. And Jay, any comments?
He's certainly correct in everything he said, other than if he was talking about the McCollum case, though, the majority opinion was written by Hugo Black. Douglas wasn't on the court at the time. But, yes, everything he says about the Jefferson letter and the Danbury Baptists, is my understanding is that's exactly what happened.
Great. Well, thank you for that call. And we move to Jim in Waukesha. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Interesting show today. I'd like to ask two things. How was this dealt with in the popular press? In Illinois, that would have gone up to the lakeshore and been Colonel McCormick's Chicago Tribune. Likewise, what about the great University of Illinois right there? Did McCollum have allies and supporters, or was there just too much anti-communism and or conflation of this with godless communism?
Right, and there was that. All right, thank you, Jim.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll answer the second part first, of course. You know, the McCollums did have some support, but in general, meaning in the community, but in general it was mostly very quiet support. You know, again, we're on the cusp of this whole Red Scare anti-communism part of our history, and just as, you know, in the 1950s, nobody wanted to admit that they even, you know, knew anything about communism or had friends who were communists. The same kind of thing happened with McCollums. A lot of people really didn't want it to be known publicly that they were friends with the McCollums, but they did have support, and not a lot. And again, it was quiet, but their biggest support came from the Unitarian Church here in Champaign-Urbana, and a minister named Philip Shug, who was really very much a hero in this case as well. He was very public in his support of the McCollums. And there were other actual religious groups from around the country that sent her letters of support.
exactly who they were, I can't remember off the top of my head. So we have to remember that there were then, and there still are today, very, very many religious groups who feel very strongly that our government should not be involved in religion at all, and that there should be a separation. But as far as the press goes, and Colonel McCormick's paper, which he's referring to the Chicago Tribune, you know, the Chicago papers were probably a little more fair to her than certainly a lot of the media in other places in the country. Certainly, you know, there were two newspapers at the time here in Champaign-Urbana, and one of them was clearly very strongly against her and played up all the sort of controversial aspects of the case to the max. And I found that the Chicago press were a little more, I think, reasonable and a little more reliable in general. There were a lot of newspapers at that time in Chicago, so actually, you know, it's a little difficult for me right now to remember exactly which paper did what. But in general, I thought the Chicago press was, you know, pretty okay with her.
Going back to the Unitarian minister, were the McCollums members of the local Unitarian church, or was that minister just sympathetic to the cause?
At first, he was just sympathetic to the cause, but then they eventually became members of the Unitarian church. But he was actually, it wasn't just that he was sympathetic to the cause. That church actually was, at the time, kind of out front on this issue. And the minister didn't find Vashti. It went the other way. She had actually seen a newsletter that was printed by this Unitarian church where Philip Shug spoke out against this idea of bringing religion to public schools. And that's how Vashti realized that he could be an ally for her.
And another phone call here. We take Marcia next in Ellison Bay. Welcome, Marcia.
Hi, thank you. I came upon the program, and so I haven't heard the whole thing, but I wanted to tell you that my husband and I lived in Champaign-Urbana area for 40 years, and Daniel McCollum, one of Vashti's sons, later became the mayor of Champaign and served several terms and cares very deeply about his community. He's written a history of Champaign County. Champaign-Urbana has a huge Asian population, many from East India and Korea, China. There's a Hindu place of worship being built in northern Champaign right now. There's a large synagogue and Jewish population, and there's also a large mosque there. My husband was a Protestant pastor, and I worked at the Wesley Foundation on campus, and there's a great deal of appreciation and sharing and dialogue among the various religious groups in Champaign-Urbana. Or at least we experienced that, and we're very appreciative of what the McCollums did, and we believe very strongly in the separation of church and state as well. And I just want to say also that one of the other important landmark decisions that came through the Urbana schools was that the school district had to finance, I think equally, physical education and sports for girls. So that was an important decision that came through Champaign-Urbana as well.
Great. Well, thanks for that perspective, Marcia. That's an interesting bits of Urbana history there as well.
Yeah, I should. She made some very good points, and thank you for saying that. I think one of the most ironic twists in the end of this case is that Vashti's middle son, Dan McCollum, you know, this family was completely ostracized by the entire community, by Champaign, Illinois. And then years later, Dan actually did get elected mayor and served three terms as the mayor of Champaign-Urbana. So, you know, he was sort of able to turn this around and find a way for the community to embrace him. And he's still lives here, and he's actually the official historian of Champaign-Urbana. He's really one of Champaign's leading citizens today, which is great the way things turned out. And I should also point out he's written a book about the case, and it's called The Lord Was Not on Trial. And, of course, you notice the similarities between the title of my film and his book. And
now this is Dan?
Dan McCollum, yes. And you could find information on the book online, of course.
But what about Jim, the brother in question? How did his life unfold after that?
Well, you know, he got sent away during the case because things were so bad for him that his parents sent him to go live with his grandparents in New York. And after the case was over, he was able to come back here, and things had ended up being okay for him in high school. He eventually became a lawyer and practiced law in Rochester, New York. And he's now retired, or semi-retired, I should say, and living in southern Arkansas. But his whole life, he's been very much dedicated to issues of civil liberties and these issues of separation as well. And he's still alive, by the way.
And he seems like he recovered from the trial and went on to lead a healthy, good life.
Oh, yes, and has a terrific sense of humor as well, which is something that I wasn't expecting when I first met him. But and if you watch the film, there's a lot of moments of great humor, and they pretty much all come from Jim McCollum.
Well, Jay, thank you so much for your time this hour. It's a wonderful story and a wonderful documentary, too. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to give a plug for those people who want to find out when the film is airing.
Yes, please.
On PBS in their area, is to go to my website, which is thelordisnotontrial.com, and there's no spaces there, just thelordisnotontrial.com. But
great.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you. Jay Rosenstein, three-time Emmy-winning independent documentary producer, director, writer, and editor of The Lord is Not on Trial here today, and other films as well. Thanks so much to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and to Rhonda Fanning. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.